You're tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, or you're on the web at kuci.org. This is Mark Hart. You're tuned to Heart Talk. And we're going to have a guest on for the next 51 minutes or so. It's Yaron Brook, the director of the Ayn Rand Institute here in Irvine. And without any further ado, let me bring him up. Yaron, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Good. Okay, why don't you go ahead and you're a fellow citizen of Irvine here, UC Irvine, being the other big institution. Tell us a little bit about your institution and what you're the director of.
Yeah, it's the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand was the author. Your listeners might be familiar with Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, in which he elaborates not just of these good novels and good stories, but he also elaborates in your philosophy, a philosophy focused on rational self-interest, reason as man's means of survival, reason as a guide to our actions as compared to faith or intuition. And she was a strong advocate as a consequence of kind of rational egoism and individualism of capitalism as compared to socialism or any other form of statism. So we advocate for... We are at the Institute. We have lots of educational programs as well as advocacy programs where we advocate for her philosophy and apply it to kind of current events.
Tell us a little bit about your background. You've had some other professional ventures as well.
Yes. I am, I've got a PhD in finance, and I served as a finance professor for 7 years up at Santa Clara University in Northern California. If you go further back than that, I served in the Israeli Army, was born and raised in Israel, and served in the Israeli Army for 3 years and got my undergraduate in Israel in civil engineering.
Excellent. Now, there's one curiosity point. Why was Irvine chosen to be the center, the place where the Ayn Rand Institute is located? I've always wondered that.
Well, basically, because I live in Orange County, so it's not. There's no other sneaky reason. It's the organization was founded in Marina del Rey, and that's where the founder, the original executive director, lived. And when I took over, I moved down. I was living in Orange County. I moved down to Orange County, and ultimately moved the institute down to Irvine.
Okay, it's nice.
To this store and ask for a map of the course. Hello?
Good. It's good. That's nice. It's good to be king. Okay.
Absolutely.
It's good to be king. Well, you know, rational self-interest.
CEO, you know.
Rational self-interest. Okay, we've got about 50 minutes left here on Heart to Heart Talking. My name is Mark Hart. This is KUCI. We're on the campus of UC Irvine. The views expressed in this show are not the views of KUCI, the University of California, Irvine, the California UC system, the regents, the board, the governor, anybody else. And I see you're multitasking there. You got your kids in the background?
I got my kids. We're actually at a ski resort in Colorado while we speak, so
okay.
The timing's not great. But
you're on a slope in Colorado.
I am on a slope in Colorado, standing on snow.
I had no idea. I thought you were going to be in the office. Sorry, my bad.
All right. No, they caught me on vacation, these guys.
Oh, well, I really appreciate it. It's great of you to do that. I may or may not have a surprise caller in at the bottom of the hour. We'll see. He would be my guest lefty, but I'll have to play the lefty, I guess, or whatever the opposite side you are on. So
that sounds good. Can you give me two seconds here?
You got it.
I'll
let
be
me,
right with you.
Yeah,
okay.
Let me go to I'll go ahead and waste some time here. All right. Again, that's Yaron Brook. This is Heart to Heart Talk. If you're listening, I can't take callers mainly because I don't have a screener, and there might be you need screeners by law. But in any case, Yaron, you're back up.
You guys can get into your skis. I'll get you lift tickets.
Well, okay. This is interesting. The guy's skiing and talking politics at the same time. All right. There's been obviously it's been a very important week in the nation, the state of the nation. There's been some events in the war, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about. Yaron, you're back?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All right. Yeah, if you need to cut out, let me know. I should probably have some music.
Yeah, I'll need to cut out for 2 minutes here in a second, and then I'll be all yours. I just need to get something done, and then we'll I'll be all yours.
Why don't you go ahead and cut out now? So, anyways, the big event was there was an election in Iraq, and you know, whether that'll lead to anything permanent or not. I mean, there've been, as it has been noted, there have been elections in Iraq before, and they've all, you know, over the long term, they've all led to bad things, dictators. I believe there were some elections in the 50s, and that didn't last too long. So, but we hope that'll lead to something. The people who are against the war in the first place, you know, don't really care. But actually, people against the war kind of hope that, you know, that the country fails and turns into a mess. If that happens, it could be worse than it was before. I mean, many people on the left say that we should have just stayed out, even though Saddam was a bad guy. At least he was a stable force and someone who would keep down al-Qaeda. And, you know, sometimes you have to do business with the devil, as it were. Other people say that Hussein was already dealing with terrorists and was sort of surreptitiously supporting the Palestinian cause and, you know, thus causing problems there. So, you know, he wasn't the, you know, the kind of grade A terrorist we were looking for in terms of Osama bin Laden, but he was, you know, one anyways and bad enough. So it's a good thing we took him out. You're on, you back? Okay, I guess not. It can go either way on the left and the right. I supported the war in Iraq and did from the start. I've had a talk show on and off since the fall of 2002. And actually, since January 2003, on and off, I've had some sort of talk show. And from the very beginning, I supported it. I thought there were at least 7 or 8 good reasons why we should go to war. I never was, you know, my top reason was never WMD. What I latched on immediately and what I sort of like about this venture is that it is a long-term attempt to once and for all quell Islamic terrorism. Now, you know, my fear of a lot of, you know, politicians and a lot of presidential candidates in the last election was that they would just take a short-term Band-Aid approach. You know, whether you agree or disagree with Mr. Bush, at least he is attempting to execute a long-term solution. And that is that he believes, and I believe as well, he and or his people believe that the long-term solution would be to democratize the Middle East and basically give these you know, disenfranchised, disenchanted youth something to do, you know, other than mill around and be preyed upon by unscrupulous, you know, terrorists using Islam and religion as a front for killing people, as a cover for killing people. And killing people indiscriminately. I mean, you know, one of the things you see about this the current Iraqi situation is that, you know, the al-Qaeda terrorists apparently have no problem blowing up children and even, you know, even staking out places where children will be, where, you know, American soldiers handing out toys or something and blowing up the children. I mean, this is, you know, do you really think Muhammad would have supported this? This is really quite disgusting. And then on the other side, you have the political insurgents and the ex-Sunni or the ex-Saddamites are a bit more logical, a bit more humane, if you will, about it. You know, they're trying to reach a finite goal, and that goal is to, you know, to have the Sunni population be taken care of and, you know, not being impoverished and also not having a backlash by the Shiites because of the, you know, the years of suppression under Saddam Hussein. So at least the Saddamites have some sort of rational, logical goal. And you notice that over the election, the Saddam-type insurgents or the Sunni-type insurgents, they actually acted as a police force in protecting the polls. I just read this edited in protecting the polls against al-Qaeda. So at least the Sunni insurgents, you know, are working towards something. And they've decided, finally, thank God, that they can get more done by voting and by being a voting bloc and by forming a coalition with the secular Shiites, with the Kurds, and forming some sort of bloc that may equal or surpass the religious Shiites. So, Yaron, you back? Yaron? Are we there? Yaron? I don't know. I think we might have lost him. In any case, looks like I'm going to have to fly alone on this. Iran, you there? Okay. Looks like I'm going to fly alone on this. So, anyways, we're going to go on about the political situation. Now, I watched most of the address. Iran, you there? I watched most of the address on Sunday night, and I was pretty impressed. I think he laid his case out pretty well, and he laid his case out to you know, the American people. And I thought, you know, I think his points are basically pretty sound. So, anyways, go ahead and chew on that. We're going to go to some music for a little bit and see if we can get things back up here. You're on? You there? Okay. All right. I'll lock in. Okay, we're back on Heart to Heart Talk. It is currently 9:20. The views expressed in the show are not the views of KUCI, the University of California, Irvine, the Regents, the Governor, or really anybody else. So, Yaron, you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we're here with Yaron Brook. He's the director of the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine. However, at the moment, he happens to be in Colorado. And so thank you very much for breaking your vacation and going out of your way. I really appreciate it. I tried to get you on 2 weeks ago. I had a Hollywood liberal, as it well, a guy named Jay Leggett, who has been on a number of comedy shows and is currently a producer. And he produced some films with Christina Applegate and Matt Dillon. And in any case, so it was too bad. I wanted you two to get on because you would have been duking it out. But
yeah, that would have been fun.
Yeah, that would have been fun. In any case, I have invited him to dial in at 9:30. I don't know if he will or will not. So, you know, he's a busy guy. He has a busy entertainment schedule. Alrighty, let's get back. I don't know how much you heard, but we're gonna start out with the Iraq situation. I don't know if it's talked about too much, but in matters of war, I guess you can't talk about it enough.
Yep.
So, let's start with the last thing. What were your impressions of Mr. Bush's speech Sunday night?
Well, I mean, I'm not very impressed with Bush's speeches. I think he's completely off base in terms of what he's trying to do in Iraq. I think his whole strategy in dealing with Iraq is wrong. I think the biggest mistake that we're making in Iraq is instead of focusing on destroying our enemies, we are somehow concentrating on establishing democracy, on changing Iraqi culture in some kind of fundamental way. That should not be what American troops are fighting and dying for in Iraq or anywhere in the world. Our focus should be on what is needed in order right now to eliminate the threat Islamic terrorists pose to the United States all over the world. So the whole emphasis on democracy, the appeasement of the Iraqi people, the kid gloves in which we're dealing with this insurgency, are just all mistaken and all diverting our focus from what's important, and that is destroying Islamic terrorism.
Are you going down the slope, Sharon?
Why? Did I sound breathless? I'm going to find a place for you to sit down. So
talk about multitasking.
Yeah, I know.
I don't blame you. I love skiing myself. So do you think we should have gone there in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question. No, not really. I don't think we should have gone there in the first place. I think we should have gone to where the, you know, center of power with regard to militant Islam is, and that is Iran. Iran is the most important country in the Middle East with regard to fundamentalist Islam. They are a regime run by basically the same ideology that brought about September 11th. Until that, and their ideology, they're a regime that supports terrorism actively, the regime that endorses everything that Al-Qaeda has done and supports it. And until that regime is taken care of, we will have done nothing in the more important fight against Islamic terrorism. Okay. So Iraq was a sideshow. Iraq was not important. It was, from my perspective, a waste of our time because, you know, Saddam Hussein was never a threat to the United States. He was never a problem. He didn't endorse fundamentalist Islam. He was more of a problem to his own people than to the American people.
Okay. Let me try to answer those a little bit. First off, do you see the problem with attacking Iran right away? The problem is that there's no pretext, there's no reason, and getting the American people to support that would be pretty difficult unless you find some sort of smoking gun between Iran and terrorism and the attacks on 9/11. If you can't find that, you won't get any support. And unfortunately, when it comes to the, you know, fighting wars in America, you have to have support. That's why some people say Roosevelt allowed Pearl Harbor to happen so that he could have his excuse.
That's true.
But there's no smoking gun. But
let me just make this point. I don't think it would have been a problem to get the American people motivated and behind a war against Iran if the whole issue would have been articulated properly from the beginning. That is, if directly after September 11th, President Bush had come out and said, we are now under attack from an ideology. That ideology is called militant Islam, totalitarian Islam, fundamentalist Islam, whatever you want to call it. This ideology has a home. That home is in Tehran. This ideology really came to the surface and became established in 1979 when Ayatollah Khomeini took over the Iranian regime and at the same time took 44 American hostages and kept them for 244 days. It was longer than that, 444 days. Kept them for 444 days. That was the first opening shot of a war that we've been engaged in since. Since then, the Iranians have been responsible for bombing the Marine barracks in Beirut, for hijacking airplanes, for bombing the Khobar Towers, for supporting every terrorist organization in the world. They have a line item in their budget called terrorism. This is the regime that, whether it has direct links to 9/11 or not, is the spiritual, intellectual, financial, material backbone of fundamentalist Islam, and until this regime as long as this regime continues to exist, there will be terrorism against the United States. If he had given that speech on September 12th, the American people would have rallied, and an invasion of Iran would have been easy. Now, the rest of the world would have hated our guts, but the rest of the world hates us anyway, and to expect support from France is ridiculous. What we need is to place American interests first, and if Bush had articulated who the enemy is, not terrorism in the abstract, but who these terrorists are, what motivates them, what's the ideology, who's at the core of it, when it all started, what are all the terrorist events that have happened. I mean, from my perspective, November 4th, 1979 should have been the day we went to Iran. That is, the day they took our embassy hostage was a declaration of war against the United States, and I think everything that's happened, the horrific stuff that's happened since then, is a consequence of the weak response that we had to that hostage taking. The fact that we didn't take it as an act of war, and we didn't take it as declaring war against Iran and taking care of that regime once and for all.
Well, you know, you may be absolutely right, but the thing is, the problem is now the opportunities have been lost, and Carter missed some opportunities, Reagan missed some opportunities, Bush
yeah,
too.
You know, though, that I've been saying this since September 12th.
I know you have missed some opportunities. So now the only thing we can do at this point is wait for the Iranians to do something stupid, and then we can act quickly, because now we'll have troops in Iraq, and B, we'll have even if we pull back from Iraq, we'll have tons of troops in Kuwait.
Yeah, but you're an eternal optimist, believing that the Bush administration would ever do something like that.
Well, how about
I don't believe they would.
How about the McCain administration?
In my view, Iran's already done that. But the problem is, this administration downplays everything Iran does. They're developing nuclear weapons, and they're snubbing the Europeans and the U.S. with regard to those nuclear weapons. They've just called for wiping out the state of Israel, and at the same time, they're building nuclear weapons. So there's a connection between those two things. Israel is an ally. That should be reason enough. They are continuously engaged in prayer and encouragement of the idea of destroying the United States. In addition to that, they are supporting, actively supporting the insurgency in Iraq. Any one of those by itself, never mind combined, if articulated to the American people right, if presented by George Bush as a real threat to the American people, would rally the American people to do something. Now, the problem is that they've messed up Iraq so badly, that the Bush administration has done such a poor job with Iraq, that the American people now have no appetite for any military engagement anywhere, no matter what happens. So that even if we get another terrorist attack tomorrow in New York and it's linked somehow to Iran, nobody's going to advocate for going to Iran because we've obviously can't. We messed these things up. We're incompetent, as the Bush administration has proved in Iraq.
Okay. Well, maybe President McCain will do a better job next time around. But can you see the problem with making a war in the American state? And you know, there's examples back and back. I give the Roosevelt example. You know, Lincoln wanted, you know, was looking for an excuse to go to war with the South, and finally it was handed to him. But unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait for an opportunity, wait for Iran to do something stupid. And I believe that we'll be in a position to do something. Now, as far as this current Iraqi adventure, I don't think it's that as worthless as you think it is. I do believe that it is. You say it's not our business to make democracies. It's a waste of time. I think if the way I look at it, I think it is worthwhile. And it's worthwhile in this way, that if you look on a 30-50-year timeline, that what you're trying to do, the ultimate goal is to get rid of Islamic terrorism. Now, you believe that it should be crushed, and I agree. I think the stick approach is important, and there are some, you know, somewhat successful. There are some successful military maneuvers in Iraq. You know, eradicating Fallujah, and now they seem to be making a little bit of headway on the Syrian border in the west. And they are using, you know, the Marines especially are using, you know, scorched earth. Vicious tactics. There's no question. Fallujah was vicious. They even now say that they were using, chemical weapons and phosphorus and things. So I think that's being done.
They cleared Fallujah out of everybody. They cleared out all the civilians. They made it. They killed as few people as they could. They gave everybody warning weeks in advance. What happened in Fallujah, in my opinion, is a fiasco. Instead of making Fallujah an example and showing the world what will happen to insurgents against America and ending the insurgency once and for all, we let thousands of insurgents get away, and we shielded the civilian population that helps these insurgents on a daily basis. But let me address the more important issue, which is democracy. Democracy is a disaster for the United States. It's a disaster for the United States everywhere in the Middle East. Look who won, who is winning the election in Iraq. It is, there are basically two parties that are doing very well, it seems, from preliminary counts. It is the religious Shiites, who are allied directly with Iran, who spent the last 20 years in Iran and have just recently come back. They are linked directly to Ayatollah Sistani, to a cleric. The Supreme Court is going to have primarily clerics on it. And on the Sunni side, who's winning on the Sunni side? And on the Sunni side, it's the religious Sunni party is winning. So what we're doing in Iraq is establishing an Islamic fundamentalist government that is going to be, in the long run, in full support of terrorism against the United States. They're going to be complete allies with the Iranians or with the Saudis. In either case, they'll be aligned with regimes that hate the United States and support terrorism. But look at democracy elsewhere in the Middle East. When Algeria tried democracy in 1992 and they had a free election, the Islamic fundamentalists won. As a consequence of that win, the military came and stepped in and said, no, we're not going to have a religious state. And what happened was one of the most bloodiest civil wars in history, where hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. In Egypt, they just had elections. The army had to stop voting in whole sections of Egypt because the Islamic fundamentalists were winning so many votes that it was going to threaten the majority held by the ruling parties. They literally blocked voting in some regions. Look at the voting that's happened almost everywhere throughout the Middle East. Look at Lebanon, where the Hezbollah, one of the most violent terrorist groups in the world, probably the best trained terrorist group in the world, has a seat in the government, never mind in parliament, but in the government because they did so well in the elections. Everywhere in the Middle East where you hold truly free elections, fundamentalism is going to win. That is the culture right now in the Middle East, and we have done nothing to convince the Arabs and the Muslims that fundamentalism, that this totalitarian Islam is a bad thing, that we will crush it, that we will destroy it, that we will not
destroy
it. Indeed, quite the opposite.
You're wrong, but the other way didn't work either. The years and years of advocating tin pot dictators...
No, that's not my solution. And
that didn't work either. So, you know, at least somebody is saying, you know, in this case, the Bush administration, at least someone is saying, we're looking at we're trying to execute a 30 to 50 to 100 year solution. And you know what? I think it's a good a strategy as any. And that is to, you know, give these disaffected young men something to do besides building themselves up, get them involved in politics, or let them argue on the floor of the Senate and the House and so on. And also, more importantly, have an economic sector as well, and allow them to make money and do the things that Americans and British and Canadians do to stay out of trouble, and that is to make money. I mean, Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations partially, and you correct me if I'm wrong, partially as a response to the religious Christian wars in Europe. And he thought, well, what can we do to give these people something to do besides religion? And that's to give them money, to have them chase money, and that way they'll stay out of religious trouble that way.
Yeah, as a consequence of that kind of freedom and of democracy and of that kind of pseudo-capitalism, you got World War I and World War II, the bloodiest wars in human history. They came right out of that same European culture. Economics does not solve fundamental problems, and indeed, you're not going to get capitalism in Iraq. Iraq's going to be one of the most corrupt countries in the world, just like Egypt and Syria and Jordan. You know, democracy doesn't rule out corruption. And just ask where all the billions that the United States has poured into Iraq have gone. They've all gone into Swiss bank accounts of the leading Shiites. All we're doing in Iraq is in the name of democracy, in the name of the legitimacy of the United States government and the European government, establishing a religious dictatorship, ultimately what will become a religious dictatorship in Iraq, and it'll have the sanction of the United States because we helped create it. The Iraqi people voted for it. And if you read the Constitution, I don't know if you read the Iraqi Constitution, but the Iraqi Constitution is...
I've read parts of it. I discussed it 2 weeks ago.
It's just horrific. It is a combination of the worst leftist propaganda that you can come up with in the United States and Europe and the most religious right nonsense that you can come up with. So it has environmentalism and socialism and ridiculous labor laws that would never pass in the United States. Everything that's the worst of kind of the European agenda, with the worst of the religious right in the United States, religion being the ultimate source of law, the Supreme Court having a bunch of religious mullahs on there who will ultimately be the arbitrators of whether the law is consistent with Islam or not, you know, and every other aspect of religious totalitarianism. So you've got a mishmash of a constitution that does not serve American interest. On the contrary, all this proves is that America is going to help Islam become the fundamentalist Islam become dominant in the Middle East. We're going to hand it over to Osama bin Laden and his friends on a silver platter called democracy, with American young Marines dying left and right in order to protect the right of Muslims to be fanatics. That's what we're doing.
Well, Yaron, that's an awfully bleak picture. I mean, there is
but
another.
That's the reality of it.
Well, not necessarily.
Listen to what the Shiite politicians actually say. Listen to what the Sunni politicians actually say. Listen to what they actually advocate for. Not when they're in America and they're trying to buy our sympathy and buy our billions of dollars, but what they actually believe in. Look at a city like, which is, I think, much more reflective of Iraq than the rest. Look at Basra in the southern part of Iraq. A city run by the Shiites. Look at the conditions of life there. You cannot play music in that city. The local orchestra had to, for a long time, had to practice in the Communist Party headquarters because they couldn't practice anywhere else. And, of course, the Communist Party headquarters have been shut down since then. You cannot sell alcohol in the city. There used to be lots of bars there. They're all gone. Indeed, a New York Times op-ed writer who was writing about how, you know, Islam had taken over completely this town at Basra, was, after his editorial was published in the New York Times, was taken out and shot through the head, was executed. No reporting of that was done in the United States. Nobody made a big deal out of it like they did of Daniel Pearl. No, because nobody wants to admit the fact that what we're creating, particularly in southern Iraq, is a Taliban-Iran-like regime which is completely intolerant of any view other than fundamentalist Islam. That's what we are dying for. That's what our boys are dying for, so that we can create another Iran in southern Iraq. And that is a travesty. That is horrific.
Yeah.
Instead of going in and killing the bad guys and destroying the infrastructure and turning every regime that is hostile to the United States into dust, and then walking away and coming home and putting the fear of Allah into these people so they will never strike at us again, we're instead helping to establish more theocracies in the Middle East.
All right. Well, you know, you have to take a three-pronged approach, and defeating the enemy is one element. And I believe we're doing that. I think the Marines and the Army are doing a fine job in that. But there's also the other two parts of it, and that is to create an economy and create the infrastructure for democracy. Now, it is kind of messy, and you don't know which way it goes. I'm not as bleak as you are, and I believe that there will be a coalition between secular Shiites, the Kurds, and the Sunnis, whether they're religious or not. They'll offset.
The Shiites have more than a third. And the Shiites are going to have more than a third, and you need two-thirds in order to create a coalition. Nobody can do anything
with
the
Shiites are split up. There's the seculars and the religious. So the secular Shiites will account for some.
The New York Times this weekend, the secular Shiites did very, very poorly in this election.
Okay. All right. Well, unfortunately, that's where we stand. Now, the thing is, you know, what do we do next? So as far as I can tell, the best we can do is just to try to bow out and just to leave with our face intact, put our troops in Kuwait, and just kind of see what happens next. And if Iran does something stupid, we can strike. But they have to do something stupid, because you cannot fight a war in the United States without popular support, and you need some sort of cataclysmic event like Pearl Harbor. I do believe that the opportunity was lost on September 11th, and yes, we probably should have attacked Iran. But that's gone for now. So let's turn to other things. What do you think about some of the social issues here? You know, the holidays are coming up. What do you think about the whole hubbub between Christmas? You know, saying Christmas, saying holidays. You know, saying Hanukkah, not saying Hanukkah. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm a huge atheist supporter of Christmas. I think Christmas is a wonderful holiday. I think Merry Christmas is the right way to address the season. You know, if you're Jewish, obviously, you know, Happy Hanukkah is appropriate, but Happy Holidays is just a cop-out. Christmas is a wonderful pagan, secular holiday. It has nothing, in my view, to do with Christianity. Indeed, the Christians just stole this holiday, indeed, from the pagans.
That's true.
It's about
German pagans.
What's that?
The German pagans. Actually, it was created by St. Benedict, who came over from Ireland, of all places, actually, no, from Kent, from Canterbury in Kent, and tried to convert, you know, the northern Germans around Bremen and Hamburg and Hanover and places like that. Yep. And so they co-opted the winter solstice, and that's what Christmas is.
And the whole idea of a Christmas tree and gifts was a pagan tradition. The reason you bring a Christmas tree into the home is because it's an evergreen, and you bring it in to reaffirm the fact that life can survive in spite of the harsh winter.
Right, of Hamburg
and that's what
like
you're
that.
Celebrating. You're celebrating life in the midst of a harsh German or Scandinavian winter. And I think that's a wonderful thing to celebrate, and the gifts and everything, it's a very benevolent, fun holiday. You know, what we need to take is religion out of it and return it to its original secular, benevolent roots.
One of the pundits
said, "Of course, Jesus wasn't born on this day." They co-opted that as well.
Nobody knows when. One of the pundits said that by saying "Happy Holidays" instead of "Merry Christmas," it's tantamount to calling a menorah a candlestick. So I thought well, that was, it's disrespectful.
I just think it's a cop out because it's a way of saying, you know, we don't want to offend anybody, but it has nothing to do with offending anybody. If your holiday is Christmas, then it's Christmas. If your holiday is Hanukkah, it's Hanukkah. Why would you be offending anybody? In addition, I think the holiday of the land, if you will, the primary decoration out there. Most Americans celebrate Christmas, and we should be proud of that holiday. It's a wonderful holiday.
Let's turn to general government. Are we turning too socialist? What do you see happening in terms of social programs, social welfare, and the tax code? I'm fairly clear where you stand on taxes. The fewer, the better. But yeah. What direction are we going in? Are we turning into a more of a socialist state, or are we going back to our roots? Of the early 1800s and early 1900s.
Yeah, I wish. Now we're obviously moving more and more in the direction of statism, in the direction of socialism, more and more government intervention. And really, the best proxy for this, the best estimate of how much is the government involved in the economy, is to look at government spending. The more government spending, the bigger the government, the more the government is involved in every activity that we're engaged in. And government spending is out of control in this country under Bush. This president is spending more money than any president in terms of rate of growth, even if you take out military spending, than more than any president since World War II, more than LBJ, more than Johnson, one of the most socialist presidents we've ever had. So we're definitely heading in the wrong direction. They can cut taxes all they want, but at some point somebody has to pay for the largesse, whether it's in Katrina, whether it's in Iraq, or whether it's in all the social programs. This Medicare, what was it, $1.5 trillion Medicare subscription drug bill? I mean, this is just ludicrous, and it just proves the Republicans are more anti-capitalist ultimately when they get into power than our Democrats. At least when you have a Democratic president in the Republican House and Senate, you get stalemate. Nobody wants to do anything. Everything's frozen. Everybody vetoes everybody else's stuff. But when everything's Republican, they just go wild and they spend. Look at the transportation bill. The amount of pork that was in that bill, would make the Democrats blush. But the Republicans could get away with it because they're the party of small government.
I agree. It has nothing to do with with philosophy and politics. It has to do with the corrupting influence and power. And I think the American voters are ultimately, in the long run, I think the American voters are smart enough to see that. And that's why you oftentimes see these swings, these back and forth, alternating, one party in the White House, another party. Unfortunately, I think the voters made a mistake. They've given too much power to the Republicans, and no matter what they believe, how does the old saying go? Power corrupts absolutely, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Something like that.
I think yes, absolutely, that's right. But I think the founding fathers were really smart about this, and what they envisioned was a system in which politicians did not have enough power. We did not have a lot of power, and until we go back to that system, I don't know if it'll take constitutional amendments or what exactly it will take, but until we basically separate out our politicians, get them away from economics, get them away from business, get them away from regulating our lives, and force them out and force them instead to be protecting individual rights and protecting our private property, not taking and violating our rights, this is only going to get worse, and it matters not which part, it might get faster, it might grow at a faster rate or a slower rate. But it's going to get worse unless a fundamental philosophical change happens that takes power away from our politicians, not just reduces the rate at which they're grabbing things, but actually makes it impossible for them to take stuff. And that's what the Founding Fathers envisioned. Unfortunately, their system has been corrupted. Their system has slowly been eroded over the years. The Supreme Court has been horrific in that regard and just given politicians more and more and more power over the lives of Americans.
There is a middle way. I think I'm more in the middle on that subject. But I just read an economic history of the United States. Great book. Steele's the last name. STELE. Mm-hmm. Great book. It approaches American history strictly on economics. And I think the philosophy you're referring to would be that more of Jefferson and actually more importantly Jackson, Andrew Jackson.
That's right.
And unfortunately, there's a downside to it because both that that the government has to do a few things economically. You can't keep completely out of it, because if you keep completely out of it, then what you have is you have the boom and bust cycle, which was apparent all through the 1800s and the early 1900s. And one of the things that both Jefferson and Andrew Jackson squelched, based upon the philosophy you stated, was to squelch the national bank. Right, and that was a disastrous decision.
But that's a complete fallacy.
No, it's not. The regulation of money supply is crucial.
The worst boom and bust cycle in American history was the 20s and then the Great Depression. And that was caused completely by the Federal Reserve and by government regulation.
It was caused by mistakes. Yes, it was.
It was caused by a central bank. If you do not have a central bank, you never get
that's not true.
Deep as the Great Depression.
That's not true. You had the panic of 1839. You had four or five panics.
You never get hyperinflation like you did in the 1970s. So what you get with a central bank is a much more extreme fluctuations and much worse panics. Look at what happened with the Nasdaq. It dropped 85%, 90%. During 2000, 2001, that would not have happened if we didn't have a central bank stuffing money into people's pockets throughout the 1990s.
Well,
I disagree with that completely. The panics that happened during the 19th century and early 20th century were mild, were taken care of easily by businessmen and bankers like J.P. Morgan, and unemployment rates are far lower than they were during the Great Depression. And indeed, if you take the central bank out of the equation, particularly in a modern financial markets as we have today, I would argue that boom and bust will almost disappear completely. Financial markets are far better today with their sophistication. It didn't exist 100 years ago, but with their sophistication today, to deal with boom and bust much more effectively and to temper them much better than the Federal Reserve is in a position.
All right, let me comment. Interesting you mentioned J.P. Morgan. He actually was the de facto central banker until he died. But when he died, there was a vote.
He was influenced by the profit motive, which is a much healthier motive than the political motive that Alan Greenspan has.
First off, I just finished this whole book, and let me tell you, and the panic of 1839 was horrendous, and there were they were estimating 25-30% unemployment in many locations. So it was as bad a depression. It's the thing about the central bank is that it's kind of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. The downside of having that much power in someone like Mr. Greenspan is that if they mess up, they mess up big time. However, if you can get somebody good like Mr. Greenspan, they can smooth out these things. Now, the thing about the 1800s, there was nobody in charge. And every once in a while, J.P. Morgan would come in and rescue, but it was very spotty. So
What you want, because what Greenspan has done is Greenspan created the recession of 91 to 93. He created the internet stock bubble that was responsible for massive misallocations of capital in the U.S. economy and was responsible for the recession that followed the explosion of that bubble, and indeed is going to be responsible, although he won't be in office anymore, for the real estate collapse when it happens and the recession that we'll get in 07, 08 when that happens. This is complete manipulation. As Greenspan himself has written, he wrote this in 1960, the Federal Reserve is a completely ineffectual economic institution. J.P. Morgan is far more effective, and indeed today, with competitive and aggressive and sophisticated financial markets, we don't even need a J.P. Morgan. They would be far more effective at controlling the fluctuations in markets and the up and down changes that happen and the changes in allocation of capital than any central banker ever could be.
Well, I disagree with on that one. Okay, let's turn to civil liberties. Civil liberties, things are getting worse, aren't they? Huh? Now, Dictator Bush is now snooping on eavesdropping. How do you feel about the state of civil liberties right now?
I think it's horrific. I really do feel that Bush is far exceeding his powers. I think that I'm glad that the Senate stopped the Patriot Act from going past. Now let me clarify this. I think that if Bush had declared war on September 12th, 2001, and had aggressively persecuted a war and defined what victory meant and said, as soon as this war is, and I'm going to, and East would have said, I'm going to institute some emergency measures, just as FDR did during World War II. But as soon as the war is over, these measures will go away. And he'd ask Congress to vote and declare war. Then I would have been all for Patriot Acts and eavesdropping and all of that, because we'd know there was a beginning to it. There was the persecution of war, and then there would be an end to it when the war was over. But Bush never declared war. Congress never declared war. Indeed, Bush is on record as saying that he doesn't think this war is winnable, and certainly not winnable in the near future, that it's going to take decades. I don't want these people snooping around my private life for decades. So I think this is horrific. If we're in a war, and I think we are, I think we're in a much, much worse war than what I think our politicians realize. But if we're in a war, let's declare war, let's identify the enemies, let's destroy the enemies. While we're doing that, some loosening up of the civil liberties is fine. And that's, as soon as the war is over, let's go back to protecting individual rights and doing away with eavesdropping and looking at people's library files and everything else that the FBI is now permitted to do.
You know, that's one thing a lot of people understand, is that there has been a flux and a flow in civil liberties throughout this nation's history. In fact, President Lincoln suspended habeas corpus for a time. So it goes up and down. The question is, can you go back down? And that's always the fear of civil libertarians, is that, you know, once these bureaucrats get a taste of that kind of power and that kind of manipulation, they don't want it back. So, unfortunately, it's a dangerous game there. But, again, I trust the American electorate. And what I see is, with 6 minutes left, in 2008, I think we're looking at a different party and a far more liberal leftist party. What are you looking at in 2008? What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, I think the religious right is going to continue to consolidate its power in the United States. I think I'm far less optimistic than you are about the American electorate. I think there is a systematic shift to the right, particularly towards religion in this country. Even the left is shifting towards religion. So I think that the theme of future politics in America is going to be far more secular versus religious, and I think religion is gaining, because I think the secular left is bankrupt. I think it has nothing to offer the American people. I think that it's become nihilistic and against everything, but has no positive program to propose. And as a consequence, I see particularly the religious right, the religious part of the Republican Party, becoming bigger, more powerful, more influential. And actually, even in the Democratic Party, I see the rise of a religious component there that, on many things that I oppose, like separation of church and state, will support the religious right in the Republican Party. I see a coalition of religion, which I think is very, very dangerous to the future of this country. And the electorate doesn't correct, because the fact is that the systematic trend in America over the last 100 years has been more government involvement in everything, whether it's our private lives, whether it's the economy. But that is it goes up and down a little bit, so they free it up a little bit, then they collapse again. But systematically, the long-term trend, the trend line, is heading towards more socialism and less individual rights and less civil rights. And that's a systematic, long-term, 150-year-old trend that I don't see changing anytime soon. That's going to take a major philosophical revolution to change that.
Okay, the views expressed in the show are not the views of KUCI, University of California, or the Governator. You've been listening to Heart Talk. My name is Mark Hart. We've been with Yaron Brook, director of the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine, calling in from the slopes of Colorado. What ski resort are you at?
We're in Breckenridge.
You're in Breckenridge. Cool.
Yep.
Okay, I've got 4 minutes left. You're on KUCI.org, 88.9 FM, or iTunes, Public Radio, and KUCI. I'm going to give a 2 minute diatribe, and I'll let you wrap it up to the top of the hour at 10 a.m. So you're in Mountain Time, so it's 11 a.m. there.
Yep.
Let's start with the civil liberties. I am afraid of that as well. I see a general erosion. Now, I believe it started in the Civil War. Civil War was a cataclysmic event, and it started back then. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's inevitable or not, but when you look at other great empires such as Rome, over time they went from republic into dictatorship. unfortunately, I'm not sure if that's inevitable or not. If you should check out the HBO series Rome, it's really good. It's a bit like a soap opera, but it's also it's also historically accurate. And you see, you know, the Republic eventually went into dictatorship. Are we going that way? I hope not. For me, my money in 2008 is McCain. He's the closest thing you can get to a civil libertarian, although not what I would like. He's about as good as it gets, and the kind of guy that has the you know, the kind of support that just might work. All right, final word for you.
Well, let me just say, I think McCain would be horrific. He's for things like nationalizing health care and a single-payer system. He'd move this country towards socialism really, really quickly in the name of the Republicans and in the name of civil libertarians. But let me just say that I don't think it's inevitable that we go to a dictatorship, but I think there are definitely alarming signs on the horizon. I think primarily the rise of religion. I think if we're going to go towards a dictatorship, it's going to come from that side. It's going to be kind of a evangelical type dictatorship. And I think there is hope. But I think the hope is in really challenging the very fundamental ideas that are prevalent in the culture today. And that's what I think Ayn Rand's power is. To challenge those ideas and to present a real alternative. And I'd encourage anybody who's listening to read Atlas Shrugged, read The Fountainhead, read our nonfiction, and you know, go to our website, www.aynrand.org, that's AYNRAND.org, to see an alternative to the debates that are going on today in the media and among politicians. There is an alternative, a secular, pro-capitalist, pro-individual rights philosophy out there. You don't have to get suckered into to a lot of the nonsense that's being taught at UCI.
Okay. What's coming up in terms of free talks as well as TV public appearances?
In January, we're going to have a talk on foreign policy at, I think it's the Hilton in Costa Mesa. I think it's January 27th, but I don't have dates with me. If your listeners go to the website, they'll see that. In March, I will be giving a talk on why conservatives are anti-capitalist. That'll be at the Irvine Hyatt. And then we're going to have talks in May and June. In June on religion, in May, I think it's on the judiciary and what should be the criteria for selecting Supreme Court judges. All of that is available on our homepage, all the information on that. So if people go there, and go frequently because the things are updated and changed. But those are going to be all exciting and interesting talks. We always got a great audience, and we always have great Q&As afterwards.
Okay, we've been with Yaron Brook, director of the Ayn Rand Institute in beautiful Irvine. We're going to go to music. This has been Heart to Heart Talk. Thanks a lot, Yaron.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, reggae's next. We'll talk to you later. Tune to KUCI 80.9 FM in Irvine. Up next, we have Uptown Top Ranking with Big Jim and all the best in reggae, dub, and ska. All right, here we go. Heart to Heart Talk will be back in 2 weeks. And next week, we've got the other part of the team here, the tag team. And everybody have a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy New Year.